This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Nearly 2 million people in the Carolinas and Virginia are under evacuation orders for Hurricane Florence. The storm was downgraded to a Category 1, but forecasters say it's not the wind, but the heavy rain that will be so devastating. Joining us here for the Friday News Roundup is Byron York, Chief Political Correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Byron, welcome back to the Roundup.
Hi, good to be here.
Also with us is Julie Pace, Washington Bureau Chief for the Associated Press. Julie, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
And Ed O'Keefe, Political Correspondent for CBS News. Hi, Ed.
How are you?
As you know, Hurricane Florence has made landfall. The wind speeds are well up in the 90s in terms of miles an hour. More than 375,000 people, as far as we know, are without power. President Trump took to Twitter this week to offer encouragement to people in its path, as well as defending his response to Hurricane Maria last year. He tweeted, quote, 3,000 people did not die in the two hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico. When I left the island, after the storm had hit, they had anywhere from 6 to 18 deaths. As time went by, it did not go up by much. Then, a long time after, they started to report really large numbers, like 3,000. He went on to write, quote, "This was done by the Democrats in order to make me look as bad as possible when I was successfully raising billions of dollars to help rebuild Puerto Rico. If a person died for any reason, like old age, just add them onto the list. Bad politics. I love Puerto Rico." Unquote. The president's tweet is not true. The George Washington University did the research and found that 2,975 deaths could be directly related to Hurricane Maria. Byron York, there have been other reports that put the death toll well above 18 people. So what were these tweets about?
Well, the president was correct only in the sense that some of his political adversaries used this against him. It's not as if the official agencies are using this against him. And it seems clear that given the damage and given the lasting damage in Puerto Rico, the actual number of deaths attributed to the hurricane was far, far, far above the original number in the teens that we had. On the other hand, finding the exact number has been a truly inexact science. We have had estimates that go anywhere from the hundreds to 8,000. This latest one, which everyone is kind of accepting as gospel, is 2,975. These are what's called excess deaths or excess mortality. Those are the number of people who died above the normal number of people who would have died in some time period after the hurricane. And I don't believe this method has been used in counting previous death tolls from hurricanes or many other events. So this is an actual issue that the president has brought up in the worst possible way.
Julie Pace, what impact does this have, really? I mean, FEMA's got its job to do. Paul Ryan has responded to the president's tweets. I wonder if this is just kind of all politics, just rhetoric, or if there's more to this.
Well, I think it gets to something that has been a part of this presidency. There is a real lack of empathy from President Trump when situations like this happen. He has this habit of making everything about him. So you can quibble with how this number was, how researchers came to this conclusion that this was the death toll. You can quibble with, you know, whether these deaths are directly related to the storm, whether they actually refer to other incidents, but around 3,000 people died, and the president doesn't seem to be able to show any empathy for the families who lost people. He doesn't seem to be able to show any empathy for the general situation in Puerto Rico. He only cares about how it reflects on him and his presidency. And I think that that is something that Republicans really get frustrated with. At the same time, you know, you spoke about Paul Ryan. He was one of the very few Republicans who actually did quibble with what the president said. Most of the Republicans just said things like, "Hey, I didn't see that tweet," which is a pretty standard reaction from GOP officials these days.
And I think, Ed O'Keefe, the larger issue is really what the response will be to Florence compared to the response to Maria. Shelby is in Birmingham, Alabama, and Shelby emailed, "I do not wish the residents of North and South Carolina anything but the most swift recovery possible. But I also think empathy can be difficult when outsiders have no experience with the problems of others. So I wonder how the residents of the Carolinas would react if Duke Energy, the local utility, told them their power would be restored in about 8 months. If told this, they might be able to catch a glimmer of the problems the residents of Puerto Rico have suffered."
Yeah, and we should remember that the situation in Puerto Rico was so unique because it is an island unto itself out in the Caribbean, thousands of miles from mainland USA, it didn't have, you know, the requisite power poles or equipment. It all had to be shipped in. And I think part of why people got so frustrated with the response is that they just couldn't understand why there had never really been contingency plans made for this kind of a disaster. So there's that. But, you know, whether the president was trying to sort of set up a compare-contrast ahead of the storm or whether he just read something, because there had been some reporting this week by the Washington Post and the Kaiser Foundation and others about, you know, the ongoing response, the public reaction to it on the island. It's unclear, but I think Julie's right. He just has this way of sometimes inserting himself into these situations and in ways that really give fellow Republicans headaches. It was telling that this week the governor of Florida, Rick Scott, who's running in a pretty expensive and competitive Senate race in Florida where he will need to win the votes of Puerto Ricans who either have lived there for a while or just got there, very quickly distanced himself saying, I've been to the island. This is a problem. The response could have been better, and I disagree with the president.
Very large DeSantis community of Puerto Rican voters in the I-4 corridor in Central Florida. Sorry,
Ron DeSantis, who really aligned himself closely with the president during his primary for the governor's mansion in Florida, also broke with the president on this issue.
Speaking of Puerto Rico, I should note there was another storm, Tropical Depression Isaac, that had been on track to head toward Puerto Rico. Some of the earlier forecast tracks this week, fortunately for Puerto Rico, it moved further south. So currently, it looks like it's going to completely miss Puerto Rico, but on this current path, it could kind of graze the southern tip of Jamaica. I want to begin talking about the other major story that we are following this week, which has to do with immigration. The New York Times reported that an immigration milestone was met this week, a record high for the overall number of migrant children in U.S. detention, up from 2,400 last May to almost 13,000 now. Federal shelters have remained full, about 90% capacity. The Trump administration has promised to triple the size of at least one tent city where children were being held in Tornillo, Texas. Byron, can you break this number down for us? It's 12,800 children. Do we know why this number is so high now?
Well, there have been some differing accounts about whether it reflects an increase in children coming over the border illegally or whether it just reflects the Trump administration's policy of detaining more children. So in the past, if the same number of children had crossed the border, the earlier administration would have processed them and released them somewhere in the interior if there was someone willing to sponsor them. So I think it's a mixture of both, and to the degree that it's the president's policies, we kind of know what his policy is on that. To the degree that it's an increase in people coming across the border, could reflect, at least the administration says it could reflect, the knowledge in Mexico and Central America that the administration has backed off its policy of detaining children. So in the whole controversy over children who were detained, it was the larger number was always the number who had come over the border by themselves.
The Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees these detention centers, issued a statement. It says in part, quote, unaccompanied alien children apprehended are a symptom of the larger problem, namely a broken immigration system, unquote. I wonder, Ed, where the debate over immigration policy stands right now. Some of our listeners are appreciating the crackdown. Jim wrote on our Facebook page, thank you, ICE. What a great job you're doing for our great president. So clearly there are some supporters of the president who like the crackdown. But in terms of the policy from here, is that kind of at a standstill or is that moving?
It's at a standstill. I actually moderated a panel this week here in town with members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, Republican and Democrat. And it was only about immigration policy. And they all conceded that we will not see any movement on this issue before the elections. And if you see any movement on it after the elections, it's most likely to address the issues of so-called Dreamers and maybe put in place some other provisions regarding border security. They concede and they are fully aware of the urgency and the immediacy of the issue with unaccompanied minors and families who've been separated. And their general belief is that the more pressure that is brought to bear on them by Congress, by the general public, by state governors who actually have some say in the accreditation of the places that are holding these families and these children, that issue can get sorted out over the next few months. But there will be no movement on it, really, of any significance in the next few months, despite the urgency and the fact that people keep coming. And, you know, Byron, I want to point this out, because Byron is correct when he says that people have this understanding that if they come, they might be able to get through. I was down in Guatemala in July when the vice president was there meeting with Central American leaders about this issue, and met a woman who was awaiting the return of her son, who had gotten through to Mexico with her now deceased husband. Her husband died en route. The plan was to go to Houston. He took their 15-year-old son with them. And I said, why'd you do that? You got three or four other kids. Why'd you take the son? And she said, well, we've been told that if you go with a kid, you can get through easier. And that while you may be detained briefly, they will eventually let you go. And so that is literally the word on the street in her village in western Guatemala. And she was in the capital awaiting his return from Mexican authorities because it didn't go well. And it just proves that it's very difficult to reverse that understanding or that belief on the street that it's easy to get here if you bring a kid with you.
Rick in Hyattsville, Maryland, emailed, Trump's administration had no intention of returning those children, or they would have had a way to reunite them, not even hospital wristbands. Another immigration story we're watching has to do with the arrests at the U.S.-Mexico border. The number of people who were taken into custody for illegally entering the U.S. is up 38%, according to the Washington Post. 13,000 members of migrant families were arrested last month. That is the highest total for the month of August on record. Now, Julie Pace, border crossings often are high in months like August when the weather's warm and kind of stable. What should we take from this increase? It is one data point, but what should we make of it?
Well, you're right. It's one data point, and you're also correct that we tend to see higher numbers of people attempting to cross the border in the summer. It's been happening for a number of years. Look, I don't think it should come as a surprise to anyone that under the Trump administration that you would see a more aggressive attempt to stop people from crossing the border. This is what Trump campaigned on. This is what a lot of his voters want him to do. And the reality is, it is illegal to come into the United States if you do not have proper paperwork, proper clearance to get into the country, if you're just trying to cross the border illegally. So there, as Ed said, there is a lot of discussion in some of these Central American countries about ways you can get through loopholes in the system. But ultimately, it is illegal to cross in unless you are authorized to do so. And I think the Trump administration is definitely trying to crack down on that, and that he has Trump has a really receptive audience for that, not just among his supporters, frankly, but a lot of people who think that this just isn't right.
I was just going to ask you about that, Byron, in terms of how the administration is interpreting this data. Homeland Security officials called the surge in arrests a crisis, in their words.
Well, to build on what Julie said, one of the things that's inexplicable is why the president has not been more effective in pushing his proposal for a wall, because clearly one way to address this problem is to reduce the number of illegal crossings at the U.S.-Mexico border, not at ports of entry. So the president has said, well, we'll get it in the next bill, we'll get it in the next bill, we'll get it in the lame duck, as if perhaps a Democratic House would help that along. So the president, in my opinion, has really squandered a lot of chances to get more funding for a border barrier. Let's use the wall word if we have to. But and it was really, I think if you look at all of his campaign promises, it was the most prominent campaign promises. I covered a ton of Trump rallies. It got to where it was call and response. The president said, we're going to build a wall, and who's going to pay for it? And the crowd would yell, Mexico. And et cetera. Mm. So this, you know, if a president is going to run for reelection and said, I kept my promises, Donald Trump, this would be his promise.
So where did that fall apart, Byron? Like, at what point do you think, and I'd like your perspective on this too, at what point do you think that began to slide down the priorities list? Did Congress just focus on other stuff?
Well, I think the president deserves a lot of blame for it, because I personally think at some point in this saga, there was a straight wall for DACA deal, basically, which is the president says, everybody in DACA, they're here, they're legal, case closed. Now give me $25 billion for the wall. And I mean real money, not a promise. I want a trust fund, $25 billion in it. I do think there was that kind of deal. But then they added other things. They added other immigration issues.
Is this that four pillars thing we talked about
a
while back?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And Congress, and I will say, you know, in just 10 or 12 years ago, Congress passed the Secure Fence Act of 2006, I think, which would have solved a lot of the problem, built a really impenetrable border on maybe 700 miles of the border. And you don't have to cover all of the border. Trump has never even promised that. And there was a bipartisan consensus to vote for it and a bipartisan consensus not to enforce it. And that is kind of the story of immigration law, because many people in Congress want to appear tough on this issue, and then they don't want to actually do it.
Ed?
Yeah, everything he said. And they did it again in 2013 in the Senate with the bipartisan comprehensive immigration reform bill. It would have hired 30,000 Border Patrol agents, would have built about 700 and paid for 700 miles of wall. It never got through the House. So this dates back throughout this entire century. And I think Byron has a point that the president could have been pushing more aggressively for this, but was told by members of both parties, but especially his own, that we cannot continue to push on this because it's going to lead to more shutdowns, more gridlock on the floors of the House and the Senate. And it's not an issue that a lot of Republicans or Democrats, but certain segment of Republicans don't want to run on this and don't believe it's worth it.
But the president was also told by some of his advisors to not accept this deal that Byron
Correct,
is talking
right.
about, because it was a trade. You would get $25 billion for the wall funding, and then you would let the Dreamers stay in the country and sort of finalize that program. And some of his advisors simply don't want to let those Dreamers stay. And they said, don't take this deal. It's a bad deal. Your base will be unhappy. But actually, it could have gotten him much further toward building the wall, which I think Byron is right. That is the central promise that his voters want to see progress on.
One more immigration story before we move on. And Ed, I wonder if you could help us make sense of this. This is a story about ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, getting millions of dollars that were supposedly pulled from other national security programs. The Department of Homeland Security fed $169 million to ICE for migrant detention and removal. The money was taken away from agencies like TSA, FEMA, and the Coast Guard, which are part of ICE. This seems especially acute this week, Ed, because of Hurricane Florence and because FEMA is part of DHS.
And for 8 years, the Obama administration would take money from ICE, TSA, and the Coast Guard and give it to FEMA to pay for natural disaster relief. This is what budgeting is. And when you're in a massive department like Homeland Security with a bunch of disparate agencies and you have somebody who has authority to move the money around, political priorities are met by moving around the money. And the Trump administration puts more of an emphasis on immigration enforcement, so they're going to move money over there. The FEMA money that was moved was mostly for sort of headquarters operations. It was not out of the disaster relief fund. It was not out of grant programs that go to mitigate disasters. It was basically for agency operations, and the administration says at least it was money they didn't feel they needed because things were operating rather efficiently. The risk, and what they may learn here in the next few days, is that FEMA is now going to need that money because they're going to have to deploy agency officials starting today, and it's going to start to get expensive. And this happens every year that there's major fall hurricanes, because you run up against the end of a fiscal year when the disaster relief fund starts to run dry. You got to replenish that fund, and then there are going to be all these questions about, well, how can you move all this money around? Maybe we shouldn't let you do that. Again, the inverse was true when Obama was president. This is budgeting, and this is proof that budgets are often just political statements.
Let's move on to a bill that the Senate is expected to vote on this week. It's called the Opioid Crisis Response Act of 2018. It's a legislative package that's designed to help curb America's opioid epidemic. It earmarks funds for everything from combating overprescription to boosting access to treatment to helping police combat distribution. Some experts say it doesn't go quite far enough. Julie Pace, could you give us a sense of what's behind this bill? Supposedly, it was a pretty major undertaking to bring this together.
Absolutely. So if you talk to lawmakers, when they go home to their districts, to their states, opioids and the opioid epidemic is one of the things that they hear about probably more than anything else in places like New Hampshire, in Ohio. This is something that is really ravaging a lot of communities. And so you do see actually some rare bipartisanship here, people coming forward and saying this is something that we actually have to get together and resolve. Now, That is often not as easy to do as it sounds for lawmakers, but you do have some powerful people who have been pushing this. It does seem like the Senate will be able to make some progress. There's some questions about whether there's enough money behind it. That seems to be the main concern from advocates, from healthcare professionals, that this is addressing some needed loopholes in the system, the way that opioids can be sent through the mail, through the U.S. Postal Service to get into communities. The money does seem to be the big question, but I do think if this gets forward, it is progress. It is a sign that lawmakers from both parties can get together and actually accomplish something. Because again, when these lawmakers go home, this is what they hear. This is what is really happening on the ground, not something that we hear about in Washington as much, but a real problem that is ravaging communities.
And Byron, there are some other efforts beyond Congress, clearly, to try to do something about this epidemic, including one from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee. It says it will no longer cover prescriptions for OxyContin, which is one of the nation's most popular relievers of moderate to severe pain. Its decision follows a similar move from Cigna and from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Florida. Both of them dropped OxyContin coverage last fall. We've heard from people, Byron, when we do shows about the opioid epidemic, saying that people who have a legitimate need for OxyContin end up caught up in this dragnet, and they're the ones who get hurt because pain management is a real thing. On the other hand, if it feels like Congress isn't doing enough, eventually someone's going to step in and try to fill the gap. Like, where does this leave us?
Well, you can understand an effort like this. I think somebody called this the whack-a-mole approach to dealing with this problem, because certainly people who are addicted are going to seek some sort of other opioid to satisfy their addiction. And you go to any hospital, go anywhere. I mean, they have a great need for pain management medication. So I think some of the more obvious ways are, I didn't know so many opioids come to the United States from China through the U.S. mail. I mean, some of the big parcel carriers, FedEx, UPS, et cetera, have already had measures to deal with that. But the U.S. mail was doing it. So I do think there are more obvious and more effective things that could be done.
It's another epidemic the FDA says is on the rise in America, and that's the use of e-cigarettes among teenagers and kids. This week, the FDA announced a new set of enforcement actions aimed at reducing sales and marketing of e-cigs to teens. The Food and Drug Administration says that has reached what it calls epidemic proportions. Before we continue and talk about some of this week's primary elections, Julie, I want to go back to our conversation about immigration and border crossing. A number of you wrote in after that discussion to mention asylum seekers. One listener tweeted, "Asylum seekers can legally cross the border anywhere. Their obligation is to present themselves to a judge, police, or other government offices like a mayor or governor to declare. They do not have to cross at legal crossings, although it's preferable to do so." Julie?
No, that's a great point. And I should have mentioned that when we were talking about border crossings, it's one of the things that some immigration advocates are concerned about when it comes to the Trump administration's hardline policy, that people who are coming here with legitimate asylum claims are going to be arrested, turned back, and may ultimately just decide to not try to come to the United States altogether. I think when you look at this in totality, though, it really highlights what a difficult problem this is. There are so many layers to the immigration debate. There is no easy answer to it. You do have people who are trying to come into the country for legitimate reasons, and plenty of people who are trying to come in without legitimate reasons. It is much more complicated than what our politics currently allows for.
Let's shift gears and talk politics, although I just noticed Byron and Ed are not wearing ties today. I'm the only guy in here who chose to wear a tie. I'm loosening
Casual
mine.
Friday.
Yes, I'm loosening mine. Goodness sake. Let's talk primaries. They were held in three states this week. That's much better. New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and New York. Let's start with New York, Byron, particularly the race between the incumbent governor, Andrew Cuomo, who won the Democratic gubernatorial primary. He quelled what you might consider a kind of a liberal rebellion from actress Cynthia Nixon, who was running as an insurgent candidate. Governor Cuomo won by nearly 30 percentage points. What does this race tell us about Democratic politics in New York right now?
Well, you know, I think that if so many of us, and I include myself, were not obsessed by the Trump administration every single hour of every single day. What's going on in the Democratic Party would be a huge, huge story. And I think basically what has happened is that the Hillary-Bernie fight has just continued without Hillary and Bernie, well, kind of with Bernie. And I think what we've seen in a number of races, certainly in this New York gubernatorial race, is the sort of insurgent progressive forces challenging incumbent Democrats, and then incumbent Democrats, terrified, moving to the left to try to deal with this challenge. Cuomo did it very effectively in retrospect, 65-35. That's pretty decisive. I think he had a progressive challenger 4 years ago, beat him by about the same margin. But in some other places in the country, and even in the New York State Legislature, you've seen progressive forces actually making a dent here. So I think this battle is actually just going to continue, although in this case, it was a case in which the establishment won.
Yeah, you're right. Governor Cuomo, I just looked it up right quick, in 2014, Andrew Cuomo got 62% of the vote. Zephyr Teachout got 34% of the vote. And Zephyr Teachout ran again.
You are fast. This time.
You know, I got to be quick to hang with the three of you. But, Ed, there was also some controversy over this flyer that was sent to Jewish New Yorkers that said that Cynthia Nixon was anti-Semitic. What was that about?
And it was a flyer that had the New York State Democratic Party disclaimer on it. The Cuomo campaign denied they had anything to do with it, but it looked awfully suspect. And the fact that it was mailed over what was a high holy Jewish weekend, basically, right ahead of Rosh Hashanah, was an extra slap in the face. It wouldn't have ultimately made much of a difference. I think Cuomo was always forecast to win by double digits, and he certainly did. You could do 3 hours on the politics in New York, and some of your sister shows up in the Northeast do. I'm from Albany, so I know this well. And I think the more significant win there was that there was a block of what called themselves independent Democrats who were in the state Senate and for years had basically caucused with the Republicans in the state Senate to keep the state Senate Republican. So you've had divided government in New York for generations. And now most of those members of this bloc lost their primaries last night and diehard liberal Democrats won. So the Senate will probably flip to be Democratic. And New York, for the first time in generations, will be completely Democratic controlled. And that will fulfill the hopes and dreams of a lot of liberals in that state who say, look, this is a state that is overwhelmingly Democratic. It should govern that way. And Andrew Cuomo is now being forced to do it. For years, he cast himself as a moderate who could build bridges. And he figured that that might be something that would compel him to run for president one day. That probably won't happen at this point.
Is that the kind of thing? You said you're from Albany.
Yeah.
So as someone who is a New Yorker, is an Albanian?
We're an Albanian.
Albanian, yeah. Okay.
I like to say I'm from the 518 because that's the area code.
All right.
Upstate America.
Well, someone from the 518. Yeah. Is that something that kind of falls in line with what New York voters have been wanting for a while, that the state would govern more democratically on the executive side and the legislative side? Is this like a reaction to the Bernie wing? Like,
No. This is a frustration that has existed for years among diehard Democrats in the state. When Elliot Spitzer was governor, when David Patterson was governor, Cuomo allowed it to continue, and there was a lot of concern that he shouldn't. And then Nixon's primary bid sort of hastened his decision to back these challengers and basically turn the Senate blue.
But I'll represent another part of New York State, Western New York State, where I'm from, Buffalo, the 716.
The 716,
which is a
Do we have to separate you two?
No, we're good.
We can bridge this divide.
But the Giants are the better football
that
team.
We do have to separate. Go ahead, Julie.
That has more Republican districts there. The Democrats there tend to be more moderate. Mm-hmm. And it shows why Cuomo was pushing this more moderate stance and why he thought that that was going to be a winning platform for him. But the New York State is actually a really fascinating political state. Ed and I could probably do a whole show on this. It is much more divided than some other states that ultimately do vote for Democrats all the time.
Let me stick with you, Julie, as we shift gears to New Hampshire. Unless Byron, are you from New Hampshire?
Being from the 205.
Oh my goodness gracious!
Which is far, far away. I would add one point though. In New York politics, it did seem that one issue that just arose in almost every race, including Dogcatcher, was that the Democratic candidate or the leading Democratic candidate promised to really stick it to the president.
Mm.
I
absolutely.
Mean, that's, that was, in the New York Attorney General's race, that was huge, and it was big in the governor's race as well. So that is really, that is a new factor in some of the state and local politics.
205 Birmingham, Alabama?
Birmingham, Alabama.
All right, there we go. So let's talk about New Hampshire.
Did you Google that too while you were sitting there?
I knew it, and then I
confirmed.
He just
knows area codes?
Okay, and then wow. I confirmed. Let's just talk about New Hampshire. Democratic okay. voters in New Hampshire selected Molly Kelly, who's a former state senator, as their nominee for governor in the primary on Tuesday. Here is part of Molly Kelly's victory speech.
Let me send a message to Chris Sununu. Do not underestimate me. I've been underestimated before. And as a single mom raising three children, working my way through college and law school to open doors of possibilities for myself and for my children. And as I ran against an incumbent Republican leader and won that state Senate seat, and now as I run for governor.
That's Democratic gubernatorial nominee Molly Kelly in New Hampshire. Now, she was backed by the political establishment, but her path to victory might be challenging. She faces the Republican incumbent governor, Chris Sununu, one of the most popular governors in the country. But with her victory, Ed, there are now 15 women
yep.
running for governor across the country. I assume that's a record?
It is. It is, at least in one cycle. We'll see if they all win, but that is definitely a record. There are also six all-female U.S. Senate contests this year across the country. That, too, I believe, is a record high. There might have been seven, but there will be six. Elizabeth Warren's opponent is a man. So, you know, you're seeing the end results of the record number of women who've engaged. And, you know, we'll see if 15 women win governorships. But if not, either way, there's a lot of them running.
A few more primary stories we should get through before we keep going. Rhode Island, Julie, I don't think there were any big shakeups. The Democrat won the Democratic primary for governor. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse will advance to face Republican Robert Flanders in November. Rhode Island, kind of as expected?
This was the establishment fighting back in Rhode Island against what Byron had pointed out, some of these progressive challengers. Gina Raimondo, who's the sitting governor, was able to fend off her primary challenger. Looks pretty strong for the general election, so no huge surprises there, which came as a relief to those Democrats because we have seen in primary after primary some of these sort of shocking, surprising results.
Byron, I would like to get your take on Ron DeSantis, who is the Republican running for governor of Florida. He resigned this week from Congress to focus on his campaign. He's one of several House members running for governor across the country. He had represented a district that includes Daytona Beach, Florida. What do we make of him resigning from Congress to run for governor? Is that a show of confidence?
Well, I think it's a show of dedication. It's a way of telling the governors, the voters, I mean this, I'm really in this. And it's also something that he can't do his job for the next couple of months. He's running for governor in an incredibly tight race. I mean, he has been the one. He is kind of exhibit A of how the president's influence has just been enormous inside Republican voting in some of the states. Now, though, it's a general election, and I think this is simply a kind of I'm all in gesture on his part.
Before we move on from politics, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky said this week that Republicans will be in what he called a knife fight to hold on to the Senate in November. Here is part of what he said at a speech in Louisville.
We know this is going to be a very challenging election on the Senate side. I'll just list you a bunch of races that are dead even. Arizona, Nevada, Tennessee, Montana, North Dakota, Missouri, Indiana, West Virginia, and Florida. All of them too close to call, and every one of them like a knife fight in an alley. I mean, just a brawl in every one of those places. I hope when the smoke clears that we'll still have a majority in the Senate.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking this week. Ed, is the senator correct? Will this be a knife fight?
It will be. I think the only one that you might be able to drop from that list, depending on the survey you're looking at, is West Virginia, where Joe Manchin's probably going to pull away from Patrick Morrissey, or has been in recent surveys. But all of those other ones are essentially the ones to watch on election night. And it could be a long one, since so many of them are out west. But I also think that he's doing this in some respects to scare up some more money, and to remind the base that they have to turn out for their fellow Republicans and get them elected. And he has a good skill at doing that and sort of scaring people. And I suspect that after his comments this week, some of those campaigns probably heard from a few folks who'd been a little dormant in their giving or in their volunteering.
And I do think he mentioned 9 states, and 3 of them are Democratic pickup opportunities, but
right.
6 of them are Republican pickup opportunities: Montana, North Dakota, Missouri, Indiana, West Virginia, and Florida.
It has been quite the week in media for the Me Too movement. There have been 2 resignations at CBS after allegations of sexual misconduct. Les Moonves, the longtime chair and CEO of the CBS Corporation, is out after a series of reports in The New Yorker. Also, Jeff Fager, who is the executive producer of 60 Minutes, is out. CBS reporter Jerika Duncan reached out to Fager when she was assigned to cover sexual harassment allegations made against him in a report for CBS. Fager sent her a threatening text message which said, among other things, quote, "There are people who lost their jobs trying to harm me. And if you pass on these damaging claims without your own reporting to back them up, that will become a serious problem," unquote. Julie, what do we make of all this? Especially, well, the Les Moonves story.
Right.
His ouster took a long time to come to fruition.
It did. And, you know, he might not be a name that is as well known to many people as someone like a Matt Lauer or a Charlie Rose, but Les Moonves was an incredibly powerful media executive, and his ouster probably has more reverberations around the industry than some of those others that I noted. I think what this shows us is that the Me Too movement has staying power. Yes, the Moonves situation took a long time to unfold. It took 2 pretty powerful pieces of reporting from Ronan Farrow before CBS really moved on this. There were a lot of people in CBS who were trying to protect Moonves, frankly, but ultimately he was pushed out. And I think that the message is that, you know, if you did some of these things that are being alleged, that it is going to be very difficult for you to stay in power, to be protected. This movement, again, it has real staying power here.
And I'd love your thoughts on this, considering that you work at CBS.
Look, it sucks. You never like to be a part of a organization that's dealing with these things, but we're going to get through it. I never met Mr. Moonves. I didn't know Jeff Fager, but I am especially proud of my colleagues who had been working on this, Jerika, but also Anna Werner and Tony DeCoppo and several producers who've not only worked on the allegations at CBS, but have been working on all these allegations about Me Too across society. And I'd point out one thing. Here in Washington, at least, I'm in the minority at the D.C. Bureau in that I'm a guy. I report to 2 senior producers who are women. The executive producer of Face the Nation is a woman. The 2 producers I travel with and report in the field with most frequently are women.
The new moderator of Face the Nation.
The new moderator, Margaret Brennan, of course, is a woman. They run things, and they're going to be running even more things in the future across the news division. And, you know, we'll get through it.
One last story we wanted to finish with, which is about a kind of online bullying that has a happy ending.
I just feel it confuses things when a woman works. My mother works, and I don't like it. You know, sometimes when I come home, there's nothing to eat.
Well, are your hands broken?
That was actor Jeffrey Owens. He played Elvin Thibodeau on The Cosby Show. Recently, a picture of him working as a cashier at Trader Joe's went viral and drew some shaming comments about his job in retail, like a kind of a fall from grace. Well, he got a lot of voices of support, including from many people in Hollywood, like Terry Crews, who urged people to recognize the challenges of getting steady work as an actor. And all of that attention resulted in a new job for him. He will appear on NCIS New Orleans this fall. And he's accepted an offer from writer-director Tyler Perry to appear on Tyler Perry's show, The Haves and the Have-Nots. With that, we conclude the Friday News Roundup and thank Julie Pace, the Washington Bureau Chief for the Associated Press. Julie, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Byron York, Chief Political Correspondent with the Washington Examiner. Thanks, Byron.
Thank you.
And Ed O'Keefe, Political Correspondent for CBS News. Thanks, Ed.
Great to be here.
We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
The following message comes from our sponsor, Capital One. The CreditWise app recently added dual bureau credit alerts from Experian and TransUnion to help users more quickly identify signs of error, theft, or fraud. Here's CreditWise designer, Bev Yang.
the alerts that we just released send a user a message so that it's like, hey, just so you know, this is what's different, and they can focus on the new information to decide what they want to do.
CreditWise is free for everyone, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. You can find CreditWise in your app or Play Store now.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, and on the latest TED Radio Hour, how to talk about death candidly.
Being able to accept that someday I will decompose, there is something comforting to me about that.
You can find the TED Radio Hour wherever you listen to podcasts.
Deadly protests in Iraq's oil-rich province of Basra inflame a power struggle in Baghdad that could cost the U.S. some influence in the region. The European Union calls out Hungary's prime minister for crushing democratic freedoms. In Britain, the head of the Anglican Church blasts corporate greed in general, and Amazon in particular. Also, the Catholic Church is forced to confront yet another damning report of abusive priests, this time in Germany. But not all of this week's international news was bad. Ethiopia and Eritrea opened their shared border, and IKEA has a plan for a better chair for your derriere. Joining us to discuss it is Peter Bergen, CNN's national security analyst, also director of the International Security Program at New America and the author of The United States of Jihad. Peter, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Karin Demersian reports for The Washington Post and is a former foreign correspondent. Karin, welcome.
Good to be here.
And Ron Nixon, homeland security correspondent for The New York Times and the author of Selling Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. Ron, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
Let's begin with Iraq. Protesters in Basra have attacked government buildings and political party offices. The diplomatic missions of both Iran and the U.S. were also targeted. Iran's consulate was destroyed. Rockets that were fired at the U.S. consulate in Basra on Saturday missed, and no one at the consulate was hurt. Peter Bergen, what's going on? What are these protests about?
Well, basically protests, the standard of living protests about not having enough electricity and not enough government services. So the fact that both the Iran buildings and the United States consulate were targeted is kind of indicative of this is not sort of a, it's a protest about the government in general and its inability to deliver. And what's interesting, I mean, the most powerful man in Iraq is Grand Ayatollah Sistani, who on Monday said anybody who's held government office already should not be able to run again, and which has resulted in the prime minister Abadi effectively being forced out because he's already served. And there will be a new kind of Shia-dominated government led in part by Muqtada al-Sadr. You may remember was the firebrand cleric that was very anti-American 15 years ago. He's sort of matured. And actually has visited Saudi Arabia recently and is sort of, you know, reaching out. So what you're seeing emerging is a Iraqi nationalist government that is obviously dominated by the Shia because they are the dominant ethnic group in Iraq. And the American government view on this is, you know, the Iraqis have decided. I don't think if somebody said 15 years ago, you served in Iraq 15 years ago, that Muqtada al-Sadr is going to run Iraq if it would be one of the leading political figures. I mean, American military officers would have, I mean, they were trying to kill him, essentially.
Right.
So he has changed. I was in Iraq in December. It's different from, the feeling is different than it was even 5 years ago in terms of violence, and there is some hope.
Let me step back from Muqtada al-Sadr for 1 second, Karin Demersian. In these protests in Basra, give us a sense of what's been going on, what Baghdad has been doing about it. I mean, is there something that kind of, actually, Ron Nixon, let me come to you. Is there something about this that's been kind of a tipping point for this? Was there a moment when it boiled over?
I mean, look, this is, I think that the level of the explosions and the violence in the streets and the fact that there's no real way of kind of turning it into, you know, a directional government movement, because this has been such, as Peter was saying, this is a reflection of the conditions in the country right now, and you do have split factions in the country as well. Then it's very powerful. It had a great effect, but it's not really organized from the top enough to actually be able to go in a direction where you're talking about, okay, here's the logical next step of what's going to replace the government that leaves. So I think that's kind of the open question about how do you kind of corral, harness what's been going on into something that could be positive when, fundamentally speaking, that's not really where it came from.
One more aspect of this, Peter, I should have asked you this before I moved on, but the protesters are upset with both Iran and the U.S. I mean, divisions between Sunni and Shia Muslims have been behind a lot of the political violence in Iraq, but what does this mean?
Well, you know, Iran and Iraq, some people forget, but, you know, in Iran and Iraq fought a war in the 1980s in which hundreds of thousands of people were killed on both sides. When you go to Iraq, they sometimes refer to the Iranians as the Persians, and that is not like a term of respect when they're using that term. So, I mean, there's long been an enmity, and there's a very strong Iraqi nationalist, you know, even though it's a 70% Shia country. This does not mean they're a client of Iran. Iran, of course, is, you know, trying to assert influence. But very interestingly, the Saudis are making a big play to become the most influential country in Iraq. And they obviously have substantial resources. And you're seeing a kind of rapprochement between Iraq and the Saudis.
Ron, where does this leave the U.S. in terms of our involvement in Iraq? I mean, I recall what Peter was saying about Muqtada al-Sadr and how he had really been painted as this is this evil figure that the U.S. had a strong interest in bringing down, and the idea that now he's potentially going to be running Iraq.
Right, right.
This sounds not only very bad for U.S. interests, but also like a gigantic waste of time and money and people.
Well, I think as Peter said, he has, al-Sadr has changed, so that it remains to see what he would actually do leading the country. And I think the U.S. government has also sort of taken a wait-and-see approach to what's going to happen here because, again, the protests are both against the U.S. and Iran. So it's not like you would have Iran gaining more influence. In this case, you know, we're just seeing that people are fed up with the inability of the government to deliver basic services like, you know, access to water and access to electricity. So I think as of now, it's sort of a wait and see process to see what will actually happen.
Peter Bergen, let me ask you a little bit more about Iraq. We've got these I want to be clear on the timeline. Yeah. We've got these protests in Basra. Haider al-Abadi, the prime minister, is basically, he's history. Yeah. Muqtada al-Sadr is on his way up. This sounds like a coup. I mean, how often does a protest change a government?
Well, no, because actually,
there's more to it, I'm sure.
So Iraq is a parliamentary democracy, and there was an election, and no one got a 51% majority. So they, for the last several months, they've been trying to put together a coalition. Abadi, the prime minister, tried to put together a coalition. Muqtada's faction got actually the largest number of seats, so he was in a kingmaker potentially role. And what is going to happen is that they're going to link up with another Shia faction led by a guy called al-Amiri, and that will be enough to create a government. But what's interesting is, you know, when it's easy to forget, but in 2014, ISIS was at the gates of Baghdad. I mean, you know, it looked like they might even take Baghdad. So the entire country unified around getting rid of ISIS, and Abadi led that effort. And then Abadi was also successful in when the Kurds had a referendum trying to get independence. Abadi kind of stepped in and made sure that they remained part of Iraq. So Abadi was pretty popular, but, you know, he didn't do that well in the election. It was the lowest turnout in any election they've had. And, you know, and when Sistani said on Monday that, you know, elected officials could no longer sort of stand for office, he was dumb because Sistani is the leader of Shia in Iraq, and his word is he rarely makes any kind of political statement, but when he does, people really listen.
Before we move on from this, Karin, I wonder if we could zoom out from this particular situation, if you could put this into some larger context, particularly for the U.S., if it's losing some of its influence in Iraq, including if it loses some of it to Iran. I wonder what the implications are for the U.S. in the region. Is this a turning point? Is this just kind of another brick in the wall? I mean, what might this mean going forward?
I mean, Peter and Ron might disagree, but I don't think it's necessarily a turning point, except for the fact that, you know, it's a more marked turning point for Iraq itself, but the United States has been kind of on a slow retreat for a while. It's taken on a different character under the Trump administration than it had under the last years of the Obama administration, but neither president really wanted to be glued or stuck or mired in the Middle East. It's why there's been such, you know, heated debate over do we have a responsibility to do something in Syria or not? Do we have a responsibility to you know, maintain a stronger presence and be involved in Iraq, or did we make enough mistakes there as it is and should we be getting out? And in this administration particularly, there is a sense of I guess isolationism might be a strong term, but, you know, focus on the domestic front. Don't necessarily worry about obligations to even stronger allies from which you have more to gain. So really, Iraq is not at the top of the list of things that the, you know, the administration really wants to get involved in. So a turning point, not really. And what it means is, yeah, it's another sign that the United States is losing its influence. When the United States loses its influence in the region, Iran moves in because it's there. Russia and China move in because Russia has political influence and China has money. And the question is, if the U.S. is not there for the rebuilding of the Middle East, will it have any control over what happens?
Let's move on from Iraq and talk about Europe. Lots of stories in Europe that caught our attention this week, starting in Hungary, which was called to account. The most powerful figure in Italy's new populist government joined forces with Steve Bannon, another story that we saw. President Putin was accused of poisoning his enemies, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, who leads the Anglican Church, berated Amazon's Jeff Bezos. Let's start in Hungary. In Strasbourg, the EU Parliament voted on Wednesday to sanction Hungary for posing a, quote, systemic threat to EU values and the rule of law. They were voting to invoke Article 7, which would suspend Hungary's voting rights. It's a public rebuke to the anti-immigration policies of Viktor Orban, who's the prime minister of Hungary. Ron Nixon, could you put this in some context for us? What is this Article 7 vote really about?
Yeah, so, you know, this is really about the crackdowns that have been done in Hungary, the government of Mr. Orban. They've, you know, attacked the media there. They have removed independent judges. They have attacked NGOs, sorry. And this really goes against, you know, the things that the European members say that they stand for. Now, his government says this is about their stance on immigration. You know, he has called Muslim migrants invaders and called other immigrants a poison. But this goes beyond that. And so the EU voted like 448 to 197 to start this process. And so it's the first step in sanctioning the country and removing its voting rights. Now, there's still a lot that has to go but on before this actually happens. But it is a big deal. I mean, it's a huge deal. And in some ways, I guess you could look at it as this sort of further fracturing of the EU, where you had like Brexit before, and now you have this. You had also a similar action done with Poland, and now you have this with Hungary. So it's a huge deal. It's a big deal.
Here's Judith Sargentini. She's a Dutch member of the European Parliament. She outlined to her colleagues why action was needed on Hungary.
The time has come to make an important choice. Will you let it happen that a government that violates the values upon which this union was built without consequences? Or will you ensure that the values of this union are more than just words written on a piece of paper?
That's European Parliament member Judith Sargentini, who is a Dutch member of the European Parliament. She added, quote, Orban's government has been leading the charge against European values by silencing independent media, replacing critical judges, and putting academia on a leash. The Hungarian people deserve better, unquote. Peter Bergen, put Hungary in a little context. I mean, does Viktor Orban really matter in the big scheme of things? Hungary is a pretty small country. It doesn't have a military. It doesn't seem to pose an economic threat. Is this about Hungary specifically? Is this about sending a larger message? What is this?
Well, I mean, this is the rise of ultra-nationalist and, I think, proto-fascist parties in Europe is probably the most significant trend we've seen in Europe for the last many years. And, you know, parties that were once very marginal, like Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, who's now effectively the number two, or Marine Le Pen in France. I mean, these people were very minor players. Now the second party in Poland and Hungary, they control the government. And, you know, in Hungary, Orban ran on a anti-George Soros. I mean, there were huge posters of Soros everywhere. And basically, it's anti-Semitism, right? I mean, essentially, he said that Soros was kind of sponsoring all these migrant groups. It's all nonsense. Soros has also set up probably one of the best universities in Eastern Europe, which is a Central European University, which the Orban government has, you know, hassled repeatedly, and is trying to sort of, it seems like they're trying to put them out of business.
We should know, by the way, George Soros is Hungarian. He was born in Budapest.
Yes, right. Yes, he is Hungarian. So, anyway, I think, Orban is at the more extreme end of a much bigger phenomenon that is affecting every country in Europe.
Speaking of this bigger phenomenon, Karin, let's move to Italy, where its new populist government has teamed up with Steve Bannon. Yes, that's Steve Bannon, former advisor to President Trump. Italy's interior minister, Matteo Salvini, was pictured with Mr. Bannon last week. Reports suggested that Bannon has been eyeing the upcoming European elections next year as an opportunity to foster new populist movements to take on Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel and France's President Emmanuel Macron. Now, Karin, there's some tension here between what you might call European federalists and more nationalists, which is interesting because the whole point of the EU is to kind of bind the people of Europe together.
Sure, but that definition of the people of Europe has been changing since the EU was founded, because the EU keeps expanding, because the idea is that the problems of the world have changed, and there is, you know, a difference in proximity to these problems when you're talking about migration. There's a difference in economic wherewithal when you're talking about the various, that was an issue before you even had the migration issue on the table, too, that was causing tension within the EU. So, it does make sense that, Bannon's message is picking up steam in places that have had problems. Places like Italy are probably a better first target than places like France, right? But the point is, if you keep encroaching on other parts of the EU, and eventually you kind of come at the people at the center, which are France and Germany, because they're the economic powerhouses, they if they have kind of lost their people, lost the number of countries of the EU, if more of the populist governments pick up steam, then you have a better shot at kind of making a push on the power players and the stability figures of the EU. Now, maybe next year is a little bit soon to do that because, Macron and Merkel have weathered other crises before fairly well. But the point is, if Bannon's message, and it's not really Bannon's message, it's an actual phenomenon in Europe that he's actually tapping into. It's not like he came into Europe and all of a sudden people said, oh, okay, cool, let's do this. But if there is a galvanizing movement, momentum afoot for, what the European values are, then maybe France and Germany can't really define those anymore. And then you have bigger questions about what is the cohesion of Europe in the EU.
I'd love to get your thoughts on this too, Ron, especially because there's been this debate over the last week or so about Steve Bannon here in the U.S.
Right.
There was that whole thing about the New Yorker inviting him to speak at a festival.
Right.
People screamed and yelled, understandably,
right.
And the New Yorker disinvited him. The Economist invited him to speak at their Open Future Festival.
Right.
I believe tomorrow he's speaking.
I believe
September 15th, tomorrow.
Right.
And their editors released a letter explaining why they wanted to talk to him.
Right.
We've had this debate here at our newsroom.
Right.
He's not answered, by the way. We have no plan, by the way. Before we get all those angry tweets.
So you want me to reach out to him
Slow down. I don't need all that hate over the weekend. But it's a worthwhile question. Like, what is going on with Steve Bannon, particularly? Is the playbook he used in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
built for Europe? Is
mm-hmm.
it easily adaptable?
Mm-hmm.
Is it wishful thinking? Like, he becomes more important when he begins to try to assert himself on the world stage.
Right. See, I don't think that it's something that he has to create. So he's created this organization called The Movement that's based in Brussels, and it's supposed to be a space for the far right to unite around these issues. But those things are already there. It's not something that he has to create from scratch. I think he's simply trying to take advantage of what you see across Europe in certain countries, and then give those people a space where they can actually talk about these ideas and push policies. I think Salvini is important, and as my colleague Jason Horvitz called him, the first big get for the movement, is because, his image with the populist in Europe, for him turning away immigrants, and that plays with a lot of people, and it resonates with a lot of people who feel like, like people do hear about immigration, that this is something that Italy just can't afford to do. So, again, I think that at the end of the day, Mr. Bannon is just tapping in to the sort of fervor that you see across Europe. And it's not something that he himself is building from scratch, and he's building the infrastructure for.
Let's shift gears and talk about Russia. This week, its President Vladimir Putin rejected British allegations that the Russians who are suspected of carrying out that nerve agent attack on a former spy in the UK, that they are intelligence agents. Putin also called on them to go public. Here's part of what he said. It's in Russian. It's only a few seconds long. We'll play the clip and then I'll translate.
Мы, конечно, посмотрели, что это за люди. Мы знаем, кто они такие же. Мы их нашли. Ничего там особенного и криминального нет, уверяю вас. Ну, посмотрим в ближайшее время.
Они гражданские?
Гражданские, конечно. Ну, конечно.
President Putin said, quote, "We know who they are. We have found them. I hope they will turn up themselves and turn everything. This would be best for everyone." And when the interviewer asked if they were civilians, Putin very clearly smirked and said, "Civilians? Of course they are."
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, hasn't he said that they were, I thought he also said something along the lines that they were tourists.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so like, you know, I mean, it's not implausible that you might have Russian tourists in Salisbury, but it's, I think, kind of unlikely. I mean, Salisbury is not like destination number one right, in the UK.
Right? And they just happen to have some nerve gas.
Right. And then, of course, the other dimension of this story is that one of the members of Pussy Riot, which is, you know, basically a collective that does these kind of, both music and kind of demonstrations, including interrupting the World Cup recently, and has been poisoned and is in hospital. And so, I mean, this is, I mean, Putin wants you to know that he can kill you, right? Right. I mean, he won't admit it, but right. I mean, these poisons are not available to us.
Right. No.
These are made by governments. And, you know, Putin wants to have it both ways.
Karin, were you about to jump in? I was just going to come to you with a question.
Oh, well, I was just going to I was smiling just because that interview that they did do was all levels of ludicrous, you know, talking about, you know, lovely Salisbury being a lovely town. And I think something about not liking the snow there. So they went back to Moscow.
Yeah,
they
did an interview with RT. They denied criminality, said they went to visit the city's historic cathedral, right. which
I'm sure is lovely. I've never been, but again, twice. It's just, yeah.
Let's talk about England. The person you are about to hear, despite the kinds of comments he's making, is not a politician. He is a very different kind of influence.
When vast companies like Amazon can get away with paying almost nothing in tax, there is something wrong with the tax system. And having leached off the taxpayer once, they don't pay for our defense, for security, for stability, for justice, for health, for equality, for education. Then they complain of an undertrained workforce from the education they have not paid for. And they end up not paying for apprenticeships.
That was Justin Welby. He is the Archbishop of Canterbury, the leader of the Church of England and the leader of the Worldwide Anglican Communion. This week, he launched a blistering attack on Amazon's founder, Jeff Bezos, and on the so-called gig economy, Uber, Lyft, TaskRabbit, etc. Some people were appalled that he went this far, but his speech got a retweet from Senator Bernie Sanders. Now, Archbishop Welby called modern capitalism a reincarnation of an ancient evil. I gotta say, I don't feel like that kind of comment is out of line with some of what Europeans have been dealing with the gig economy, whether it's the EU regulating new apps and the right to be forgotten, or taxi drivers going on strike because Uber is taking away their jobs.
Right. No, I think that you're hearing the same things that you've actually heard here about Amazon and Uber and all these other divisions of the gig economy. It's just being said with a cooler accent. But I think that, you know, the idea that Amazon doesn't pay taxes, the idea that they don't give their workers a livable wage, I think that that's the kind of things that, you know, and the reason that Bernie Sanders retreated, because he's made the same argument. And Amazon has come under attack from a number of politicians, including President Trump. I think the difference here is that the Europeans have tried to do more to sort of rein in these than the U.S. has. But, you know, I think this is pretty strong language in you know, using the leeching and that, you know, I think one of the things he also said, this is a modern version of the industrial era oppression of workers, and that Amazon doesn't pay its workers anything, and that these companies like that thrive in the gig economy thrive because they have independent workers and they have temp workers. And they save money because they have almost no overhead to pay for their workers.
There's also been reporting from, I believe, the New York Times mm-hmm. about the people who work at the headquarters of yes. Amazon in Seattle and right. how they exactly. are driven just as hard right. on a corporate level
right.
as some of Amazon's, say, you know, the fulfillment factory workers are driven on a more hourly level.
Exactly.
But Peter Bergen, I wonder if these comments from the Archbishop will really have any weight, what weight they might have. I mean, you know, England doesn't have quite as much adherence to church service as, say, Americans do. About 70% of Americans profess a belief in a personal relationship with God. So I wonder if he's saying this as a way to get Anglicans to do something, or if he's just railing, or like, what will this mean?
You know, I think he's just railing. And you know, it turns out that the Church of England is a fairly major shareholder, right. Amazon shareholder. So, I mean, you know, check
it's
your...
It's a shareholder.
I mean, yeah, I mean, they have, in their top 20 stocks, Amazon is in their top 20 stocks. Right. So, he didn't check his portfolio when he made this statement. I mean, if he's serious, he should divest.
Right.
Of course, you know, if you bought a dollar of Amazon stock 20 years ago, it's now worth $2,000. So, you know, it's done well. But, you know, Jeff Bezos announced, I think, just in the last 24 hours, he's giving $2 billion to the homeless. So maybe there might be some relationship between these two things.
Karen, I wonder how you see this in terms of, before we have to pause, in terms of the impact that this statement might have. I did not know that they were shareholders, but setting that aside, I mean, is he the kind of world leader who would have the kind of heft to get people to think differently about this?
He's got a historical, people are like, oh, yes, the Archbishop of Canterbury. But like, I don't know that anybody who isn't kind of like taken with Jane Austen novels is really going to care. You know? But maybe they will. I'm not sure. I'm, that's why I'm looking at everybody else, because I don't actually know how to answer
so that. So you got to be a Jane Austen fan.
I don't. I'm not sure. It just seems like it's not the most powerful figure in all of the UK.
This is one of the most quotable roundups we've ever done. This is pretty good. I don't know if Richard is a Jane Austen fan, but Richard tweeted, capitalism has been here before. We should remember the state of humanity in the U.S. during the golden era of the 19-teens, Teddy Roosevelt versus the super rich. And regarding the attack that Vladimir Putin referred to, John wrote on our Facebook page, Putin is borrowing from the Soviet playbook. If you believe this tourist visiting the cathedral trope, you also believe that Timothy McVeigh went to Oklahoma City to see the art museum. Yet to come, the Vatican is forced to confront priest abuse, and Venezuelan rebels meet with the Trump administration. Plenty more to discuss as we continue with Peter Bergen of CNN and New America, Karin Demirjian of The Washington Post, and The New York Times' Ron Nixon. Also in intergalactic news, astronomers are fighting to give Pluto back its status as a planet. That's ahead. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes the most important things need a hype squad.
Corporate.
Income.
Tax.
Corporate income tax!
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy. A very enthusiastic podcast about the economy.
Back now to the roundup with Ron Nixon of the New York Times, Karin Demirjian of the Washington Post, and Peter Bergen of CNN and New America. Let's talk about Myanmar. Yesterday, Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, who is also Myanmar's state counselor, spoke at the World Economic Forum in Vietnam. She addressed a number of pressing matters within her country. Her remarks included taking a question about the imprisonment of two reporters for Reuters in Myanmar last week.
I guess you also, as a democratic leader, don't feel comfortable with journalists being jailed.
It's not a matter of they were not jailed because they were journalists. They were jailed because the court has, sentence has been passed on them, because the court has decided that they had broken the Official Secrets Act. Mm. So if we believe in the rule of law, they have every right to appeal the judgment and to point out why the judgment is wrong if they consider it.
Aung San Suu Kyi speaking yesterday at a Q&A at the World Economic Forum in Vietnam. Before we dig into this a little bit, Ron Nixon, can you just remind us what happened with these reporters? What's the backstory?
So these, excuse me, these two reporters from Reuters went to this remote village to investigate the massacre of Rohingya men who were massacred by the military. And while they were there, you know, they were arrested and charged, as Ms. Suchi mentioned, under this State Secret Act. And so it's been, you know, this ongoing, I think, it's ongoing international reach. People are trying to reach out to her because of her status as a, you know, symbol of global human rights and a Nobel Peace Prize winner to free these journalists because they were simply going there to investigate this massacre. They were journalists. And not people who were violating the Official Secrets Act. So that's the backstory. There's two journalists trying to get to the heart of what happened in this massacre.
Aung San Suu Kyi also responded to her country's treatment, to pressure over her country's treatment of Rohingya Muslims. Here's part of what she said.
There are, of course, ways in which we, with hindsight, might think that the situation could have been handled better. But we believe that for the sake of long-term stability and security, we have to be fair to all sides.
Karen Demergen, how is that kind? I know. It seems like...
It recalls various other all-sides types of commentary, but yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's kind of what I wanted to get at, is it seems like almost everything that she says about the treatment of Rohingya Muslims leads someone or many people to just kind of shake their heads at the overall situation, especially because... she's a Peace Prize winner. There's this expectation that she'd be able to do more. And yet, this is kind of the way it goes.
Yeah. I mean, look, she was so celebrated. She was a Nobel Peace Prize laureate. I mean, like, she's been put up on this huge pedestal. And then she has a crisis in her country where, like, there is a minority that's being legitimately persecuted. And her solution was to kind of look the other way. And I know that there's internal politics in the country that make it not just an easy thing if she says we should stop doing this and it just stops happening. I get that it's a lot more pervasive and the political dynamics are much more nuanced than that. But it's just kind of every time she opens her mouth about some aspect of this crisis right now, people are just kind of rolling their eyes or thinking, you know, you had an opportunity to establish yourself as the person we all expected you to be. And you just keep making excuses every turn for what the military was doing with the Rohingya, now for the journalists as well. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any opportunity that she's taking to say, actually, you know what, maybe this was wrong or we should have done this differently, or at least let's not, you know, go after the journalists in this situation. She is backing what, I mean, she is the government, right? I mean, she's protecting herself in a way, too, for decisions that have been made before this in making this statement. And, you know, this is the other side of the coin of this figure that was so celebrated globally and hasn't really lived up to that reputation.
Before we move on from Myanmar, Peter, is she kind of a convenient foil for this? I mean, there's only so much power that Aung San Suu Kyi has. It is a military government. There's only so much that she can actually do without, you know, putting herself in real risk.
Yeah, and she spent, you know, 2 decades under house arrest of various forms. Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with what, you know, what Karen said. Suu Kyi was, you know, basically a saint, and she's turned out to be a regular politician.
Yeah.
And that transformation happened pretty rapidly. And she's let a lot of people down, I think, who admired her.
I mean, part of it is also just like people, this is the part of the world that Americans do not look into very deeply or understand the nuances of that much. And that's what makes it that much more dramatic, a shift of we thought you were a hero and you're not.
Ron?
And what to add that the UN has called for an investigation of the top military officials for genocide here because, you know, in addition to the rapes and murders, 700,000 Rohingyas have fled Myanmar in just the last year. I mean, it's a humanitarian crisis that she has yet to really speak to.
Let's move on and talk about the Catholic Church. Widespread abuse there has stayed in the headlines ever since that grand jury report from Pennsylvania in August revealed more than 300 priests sexually abused 1,000 children that we know of over the course of decades. This week, there was movement among the longtime leadership of the church with two American bishops, Cardinal Donald Wuerl of Washington and Bishop Michael J. Bransfield of West Virginia, resigning or announcing plans to resign. Then there was another report that revealed even more abuse, this time in Germany. A leaked study found that more than 3,600 children were assaulted by priests from about the end of World War II to 2014. Similar revelations have come out of Australia, Chile, and Ireland. Peter, before we talk about what the Catholic Church is planning to do about this, how have these reports been playing in Germany and across the world?
I think people are appalled, and rightly so. I mean, because these reports show systemic, endemic abuse over decades, and also often known to the authority, known to the Catholic leadership. And I mean, I think this is the biggest crisis in the Catholic Church since the Reformation, arguably. I mean, this is there's nothing you can't say about this, about the level of outrage that people have, rightly so. I think Francis, he has an opportunity in February to try and, I mean, a simple solution would be ending celibacy. As far as I know, there's nothing in the New Testament or any kind of real, Catholic theology that says that priests should need to be celibate. And these problems don't happen in the Church of England or the Episcopal Church in the same way.
Yeah, we've had a number of comments from listeners whenever we talk about the Catholic Church, about things like celibacy and marriage for priests in terms of reforms. We're also hearing from some of you today about what this scandal, this continuing scandal, means to you. One listener wrote, "I was in seminary for 2 years in Chicago, and there are so many gaps between the public and the priests and seminarians. It's a gang that cares more about promotions and fancy vestments or undermining legal protection for LGBT individuals. I have been humiliated and scapegoated for not conforming to rules while men with serious emotional, power, and sexual issues move forward. I'm very saddened, and I feel like I have no church." Clearly, the church is in crisis mode, and that, Ron, speaks to why Pope Francis announced on Wednesday that he's summoning senior bishops to meet early next year to discuss preventing child sex abuse by clerics.
Right. And the thing is, you have to look that this is long-standing, right? This is not something that just started with the in Pennsylvania. You know, those of us who are journalists, you know, we celebrate the Boston Globe spotlight investigation of the Catholic Church. But this goes back to even reporter Jason Berry did a investigation of the clergy abuse as far back as 1986. So this is long-standing, and it's not just the abuse, and not just to call it just the abuse, but it's the cover-ups of the abuse, and shifting people around, and withholding information, and not reporting the abuse. It's all of those things that I think has created the outrage, and that it continues to happen.
Do we have a sense, Ron, of what the Catholic Church, what Pope Francis wants to accomplish with this meeting?
I don't think we do at this point, because you recall that there was a letter that was sent about the Pope Francis himself covering up an abuse by a cardinal here in the U.S. So I think it's unclear exactly how they're going to deal with it. He has spoken out forcefully about wanting to deal with the problem, but again, we don't have any concrete proposals of what he plans to do.
Cecilia tweeted, "Thank you for keeping the Venezuelan tragedy in your conversations. Is Venezuela another Cold War zone?" Good question. The humanitarian and political crises there continue, and it's impacting its South American nations that have been forced to absorb more than 2 million refugees and others who are fleeing. The New York Times reported this past Saturday that members of the Venezuelan military opposition have met with U.S. officials over the past year to discuss how to overthrow Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro. And now last August, President Trump said that the U.S. had a military option for Venezuela. Ron, let me stick with you since this was a report out of your paper. What do we make of all of this reporting in terms of the military option, these meetings with opposition officials, which the administration has pushed back on? Like, what do we make of all this?
So let me start by saying this. There's no question that the situation in Venezuela is bad. You know, the economy is tanked. People can't get food. People can't get medicine. Millions of people have fled Venezuela. That being said, the optics of this are just awful, considering the U.S.'s historical role in Central and in South America and backing coups and backing dictators there, to have this reporting by my colleagues about how these top military officials, including one of the military officials who is actually on a U.S. sanctions list for human rights abuses, for suspected drug trafficking, for abusing political prisoners, was involved in these meetings. So just the optics of this, because in the reporting, they also outlined that these people tried to meet with the Obama administration, but they were rebuffed.
A story that we don't often get a chance to talk about out of Africa that relates to Ethiopia and Eritrea. They are making good on the peace deal they struck back in July. They reconnected phone lines, international flights have resumed, and on Tuesday, both countries opened crossing points on their shared borders, which had been closed for 20 years. Right. We've heard from some of you about how much this turn of events means to you personally. Skip tweeted, "I lived in Eritrea for 5 years, 45 years ago, while they were fighting for their independence from Ethiopia. I am so grateful that now, after so many years of bitterness, these two closely related countries with a rich common history are finally making peace." Yafu tweeted, "I'm from Eritrea, and we've waited for this peace and bilateral agreement for some time. Now the real internal work within our respective countries begins." Peter Bergen, give us a sense of what the future looks like. This looks good so far. Is there more work to be done, or is this kind of the happily ever after?
In the news business, so much of what we cover is bad news. We don't cover hurricanes that don't happen. We right. cover hurricanes that do happen.
Right.
So, I think this is what it's after 20 years of war, these countries have come to an agreement and it seems a very healthy kind of new relationship.
If I could just add,
sure.
I think it's a positive for both countries, in that, as one of your listeners mentioned, there's a historical connection between the countries. People have families on both sides. Plus, I think economically, it works out for both countries. Ethiopia obviously has the bigger economy, but it's landlocked. Eritrea actually has ports. So, Ethiopia has to do all of these things to get its goods and services to the country. So this works out for them. Plus, the Eritreans will be able to take advantage of trade with Ethiopia, starting with flights and phones and all of those, and people going back and forth across the border. But there's some things that have to happen, right? You got to pull the troops back. They've got to demilitarize the borders where they've had landmines and things like that set up to prevent the other side from coming in. So it's a first step, and it's a positive step for a region that has been troubled for some time.
One last story, something fun that we'd like to end on. We've done a lot of stories about IKEA on this show. And IKEA might have a fix for you if the chair that you're sitting in is uncomfortable. This might be a story of customization run amok. This week, IKEA said it would release, quote, ergonomic equipment for a better gaming experience, as in video gaming. But here's the thing. They plan to make a customized seat by making a 3D model of your butt. I am not kidding. This is on my script. It is designed to be a perfectly molded seat for you. It's unclear whether this means you need to be naked in IKEA to have them do this. That's not clear. Yeah. These seats are not yet a reality, but they could show up by the year 2020. Karen, I'm coming to you.
I am the expert on this one.
You are. Okay, that's why I looked at you. Would you buy one of these?
I mean,
and I have lower back pain frequently, so there might be something to this.
I have lower back pain too, actually, which is why I end up sitting in like weird positions half the time. So I don't know if that like a chair that made me sit the same way every single time
Maybe.
Would actually be my ideal choice. But I mean, this is, I just, as you were talking about that, I just kept thinking about, the classic copy machine prank.
Right.
Like it's not that funny anymore because it's being corporatized.
Right, exactly. Well, and you don't need to do that at the copy machine anymore. But Peter, would you be in line for this?
Yes, I think so. But I think there are going to be a lot of bad puns around this kind of new development at IKEA.
Peter Bergen of CNN and New America, Ron Nixon of the New York Times, Karen Demergen of the Washington Post, thank you all for spending this hour with us. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.